From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Marathon Petroleum got a huge tax break from Detroit to expand its refinery, and there was a promise.
There was more of a commitment from Marathon to actually get Detroiters jobs. And now, about 7 years later, they see that nobody from the workforce development program has been hired.
Plus, Iraqi Christians in Michigan watch and worry as Sunni militants sweep through Iraq on a wave of executions and bloodshed.
I can't tell you how much we are in fear of eventually ISIS moving into the remaining Christian villages.
And will Michigan have a summer that's cool, steamy, or both?
2 or 3 days of warmth, you get a storm system to come through, and then you grab the sweatshirt for a couple more.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. 7 years ago, Marathon got itself a huge tax break from the city of Detroit. In return, the oil giant promised to set up a training program for Detroiters to help them land a refinery job. But of the 194 new employees hired since 2007, only 15 are listed as Detroit residents. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today you'll hear the latest on that story, and that's in 30 minutes. But first, General Motors CEO Mary Barra was back on Capitol Hill today. She was there offering more testimony on the growing ignition switch recall problem, which has been linked to 13 deaths and the recall of some 6 million GM vehicles. Joining us now from Washington is Detroit News D.C. Bureau Chief David Shepherdson. David, Mary Barra wasn't out there all alone this time before that House subcommittee. She came with independent investigator Anton Valukas and his 300-page report. Did that help or hurt?
I think it helped, actually, because, you know, a lot of the specific questions the committee asked about the report, Mr. Valukas answered, you know, and she could focus more on what GM was going to do in the future, what policies it had changed to address the series of failures that led to the delay of the ignition switch recall for more than 10 years. So, you know, overall, the questioning was a lot gentler than the last time because the committee didn't express frustration with Mary that she was not able to answer so many different questions. And this time, there were really no questions they couldn't answer, with the exception of the why. I mean, oftentimes they were just asked, why didn't, you know, employees change the part number or, you know, communicate with supervisors? And that still remains kind of the one stubborn question of what went wrong.
So you kind of do feel that the report did contain answers. But there's still, I can gather from reading some of these quotes, quite a sense of anger.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you have universal condemnation on both sides of the aisle about why did GM allow this to happen over a period of 10 years and what was systemically wrong with the culture. I mean, over and over again, members said, you got a company of 220,000 people. Why didn't anybody raise their hand or blow the whistle? Even at the VA, with all the problems they had, there were multiple whistleblowers. You know, what was the problem at GM? And you know, they referenced a lot of the issues with GM's culture, like employees were under the belief they weren't supposed to take notes during critical safety meetings. They didn't want to put things in writing or use language like dangerous or recall or Kevorkian-like in any of these memos for fear that they could be used later by plaintiff's attorneys. And sort of that cultural failing and the need of the company to spend years and years in committees investigating and never taking action is just something that the company now finds indefensible, and it's, you know, it's not a pretty picture to have to sit there and take the, you know, take the heat as they go on and on.
Do you think, having been there once, she was ready for it in maybe a different way this time?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, they say, you know, practice makes everybody better at anything, right? And this is her third congressional hearing, and she's faced the music. She's had, you know, two, you know, significant press conferences on the report and the company's annual meeting. So she's answered a lot of questions about this tough issue. So no, I think she was very well prepared. There were certain things the committee wanted her to answer, like how much is, you know, their outside compensation expert Ken Feinberg going to propose paying victims, and she was not going to offer any details on that until they make that public sometime by the end of this month. So No, I thought she was very polished. You know, she didn't get rattled. You know, it didn't have the kind of emotional intensity that the Senate hearing had, where, you know, Senator Boxer said she was, you know, disappointed in Mary Barr as a woman, and, you know, there was just a lot of, it was very heated, which, you know, this one just didn't feel to have the same intensity.
Now, remind us again, does Mary Barr have a return engagement with the Senate committee now?
She does. It's likely going to happen in mid-July. The Senate is on its own pace. So that's probably both the good and the bad news for GM. I mean, good news being that by that point, the Ken Feinberg's compensation proposal will be out there, which will defray a lot of the questions that she got today. By the other hand, that's another, you know, 3 weeks roughly from now, which means it stays in the headlines. But frankly, you know, once GM gets through the compensation proposal and then gets through the next hearing, then the issue probably settles back to the back burner until, you know, potentially years before these lawsuits get resolved and before the Justice Department, the SEC, and the state attorney generals wrap up what could be a very long investigation.
Detroit News D.C. Bureau Chief David Shepherdson. Thanks so much, David.
Thanks, Cindy. Appreciate it.
The word from Europe today is new car sales were up in May. It's the 9th straight monthly increase, which is good news for the U.S. carmakers who've been watching their bottom lines suffer through the European sales slump. Joining us now from London is BBC business reporter Russell Padmore. Russell, it has been a long, tough 6-year slump. What happened with sales in May?
Well, we've actually seen an uptick, an increasing uptick, which is good news for the car industry here in Europe, Cynthia. It shows this gradual recovery of the economies across the European Union is now feeding through to the pockets of those people who hopefully want to buy a car. We have had high unemployment holding back demand, though. Now, in May, just over 1.1 million new cars were registered in the European Union. That's an increase of 4.3% for May this year compared to May last year. 9 consecutive months of increasing new car registrations. That's good news. The one downside, I suppose, Italy, the only major market in the European Union, to actually see a decline in sales, down about 3.8%.
Russell, was this the fact that countries that really got hit hard during the Eurozone debt crisis, is there that surge in demand where people really do need to replace their aging cars?
Well, there's a lot of talk about the fact that, and you can understand this, consumers worried about the future. We've seen it right across the world following the financial crisis. If people don't know if their job is going to be secure, they kind of hang on a bit longer to money in their pocket. And some would say they're driving old clunkers just a little bit longer. We've seen actually car sales for May year on year in Germany up 5.2%. Here in the United Kingdom, a jump of 7.7%. And in Spain, an amazing jump of nearly 17%, and that's the country which was one of those so-called pigs nations, the PIGS, the Portugal, Ireland, Greece, Spain, those debt-ridden countries which needed to be bailed out. And now we're starting to see signs of a change in Spain. Sure, unemployment is still high in the country, but ultimately, how long can people hang on to a car? People are now getting to the stage where they think it's time to change and get a new vehicle.
Yeah, we certainly saw that in Michigan during the Great Recession here. That's exactly what happened. I'm wondering, Russell Padmore, what's happening on the sides of the automakers in terms of the excess production capacity and those heavy discounts and incentives? Because doesn't that distort the true level of demand?
Yeah, it does do. We have seen people still enjoying fairly good discounts. It's a buyer's market right now. These car manufacturers and the dealers, they know that when someone comes into their store or their forecourt, they are in a situation, they may be in a situation to buy, but they might need financial help, for example. That's why companies have been offering loans. Banks are kind of enjoying that business too. But it is a buyer's market because you can go elsewhere. Now, you're talking about which individual car manufacturers, I suppose. The one that's doing quite well here in Europe, Volkswagen, its sales up 2.6%. It's doing quite well in the month of May. Peugeot Citroën had an 11% share of the market. Now, General Motors, and we know GM here in Europe, sure, we get the Chevrolet brand, but that's not quite the kind of car you see driving American roads. But we do have Opel here, which is GM's European subsidiary. It's also known as Vauxhall within the UK. Last year, sales of the GM group generally here in the European Union, 8.4% in May. The trouble is in May this year, 7.5%. So you can see that GM is still struggling, and its Opel unit has been a problematic unit. It's trying to get it back on track. There are a lot of fears, actually, that maybe GM was going to close Opel, but that has been put on the back burner. We've seen GM closing down operations in Australia, for example. It has said that Opel will be the future of its manufacturing operations here in Europe. And talking American manufacturers, Ford sold 80,000 vehicles in May. Its share of the market did fall, though, to 7.4%. And Fiat Chrysler, this, I suppose, American-Italian group,
yes,
its 6.4% share of the market, actually down from 6.9% last year. But maybe, just maybe, you can put part of Fiat Chrysler's problems down to the problems we saw in Italy with the country's economy. Italy, of course, is still trying to get its economy back on track after a change of government, and sales generally fell for the whole car industry in Italy of 3.8%. Well, we've heard from Paul Newton. He's a automotive analyst at the group Global IHS Global Insight, and he's kind of looked at the situation. He believes consumers can't go on driving an old car forever. He's noticed that people do have to update their vehicle.
Generally, we're looking at extremely low base of comparison, so there's bound to be a slight uptick. There are heavy discounts, and there's also the aging vehicle fleet, especially in a lot of the worse-off markets. They haven't replaced their vehicles for so long, they simply have to.
Well, there you go, yes, Cynthia, aging vehicle fleet.
Russell Padmore, a business reporter with the BBC and our stateside partner, joining us from London. As always, thank you so much, Russell.
Good being with you again, Cynthia.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As summer makes its official entrance this coming Saturday morning, the 21st, we got to wondering what kind of weather we might expect through the season. Will we switch on fans and air conditioners all summer long, or grab sweatshirts or jackets? For the answer, we turn now to MLive and FarmerWeather.com meteorologist Mark Torregrossa. And Mark, before we look ahead through the summer, we had some, shall we say, interesting weather overnight and through the day in much of Michigan, and maybe more this evening. What brought in all the thunder, lightning, and rain?
Well, we're on the edge of a hot dome of air, and that hot dome has a lot of energy to it. So we get what's called a stationary front stuck over Michigan. Very classic time of the year for that to happen. And then storms ride along that front, and you can get some very heavy rain, because we also get another interesting term called train echoes. That's where, when you look at the radar, the storms are lined up like trains on a railroad track, and they just follow in the same place. Some spots have had 3 to 4 inches of rain overnight.
Mark, let's look ahead and talk summer. And when we talk summer, it usually seems the subject of El Nino comes up. But remind us again, just what is El Nino and why does it affect our summer weather?
El Nino is when a large part of the Pacific, from South America to Australia, warms up more than normal. And that's happening right now. El Nino is developing. It doesn't have a real strong correlation to our summer, but there are signs that it can possibly help the summer stay a little bit cooler toward the second half of the summer. Just a weak sign. The big sign toward El Nino is that if it becomes strong, it has a good chance of helping us have a warmer and drier than normal winter next winter.
Which I think people would appreciate after what we've just been through.
Again, here in Michigan, 49% of the people love winter, 51% hate winter. So I got to be real careful with what I say.
Well, what do you see happening with El Nino and the jet stream then through the summer? You think it could kind of trend to be a little bit cooler, or are we going to go up and down?
Yeah, it's going to be an up and down. Here's the thing. It's going to be a real interesting summer. You said, will you need to turn the fans on, or will you need the sweater? I think you'll need both. I think this will be an up and down summer. We've got things that point toward cooler than normal weather. still colder than normal water temperatures on the Great Lakes. Still, the polar vortex is up there and feeding down cool air behind each storm system. And then just to the southwest, massive heat is building, and that will come toward us at times, not as massive as down in the plains, but I think there will be days in July when we're 90, maybe 95 degrees, and then here comes a storm system, and we get some of that cooler air off of the lakes and off the north. So it's going to be an up-and-down thing, and when you get something like that, you can also have a very active storm track.
Ah, what about precip? Because it's such an important factor, not only for tourism, but certainly for agriculture.
I don't see it being extremely heavy. I say that after we just had 4 inches in places overnight.
Right.
I think storms will move through the area. You know, we might have a day of rain, but I don't see it as being extremely light or extremely heavy. I see it being fairly normal.
So not a drought and not a washout. So it sounds like all in all, a little just kind of fairly in the middle.
I think it could turn out to be a pretty nice summer. And then if you are craving more summer and you're worried about, oh, maybe the calendar says it's going to be short, you got to remember that if El Nino continues to turn strong, the effects of it start to show up in September, October, perhaps, when we start to stay warmer than normal, when we should be cooling down. So we might have an extended summer on the backside of this summer.
We will watch and see. Your accuracy rate is great, so we'll keep our fingers crossed for that beautiful fall. But right now, enjoying summer, and thanks for the advice from MLive and FarmerWeather.com meteorologist Mark Torregrossa. Always good to talk with you, Mark.
You're welcome.
The United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, periodically issues reports on the state of the world's climate. And the most recent report from the IPCC is sobering. It states clearly that nobody on this planet will be untouched by the impacts of climate change. We're joined now by one of the contributors to the report. He shares the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize for his work as an investigator and contributor with the IPCC. He is an emeritus professor of geophysics at the University of Michigan. Henry Pollack, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
What would you say from your heart was the most important message that the world should understand from that latest IPCC report?
I can encapsulate it for you. The message starts out saying climate change is real, that humans are the principal factor in the change today. The consequences are not going to be pretty, particularly rising sea level, and the window for doing something about it is getting shorter and shorter. So in a nutshell, it says we have our work cut out for us, and we should stop imagining that there's lots of unanswered science still in the pipeline.
And just to be very clear, this is a report from experts around the world, academics. This is not governmental. This is not one side or another side. This is trying to look at the science, at the pure science.
Exactly. It is a report not of original science that the intergovernmental panel does, but it summarizes original science by climate scientists from around the world and tries to put it together in a coherent fashion and extract the common themes that the research has produced.
What, Henry, does the report predict would be the impact on the way that we would live our lives day to day? If things are not changed and if the ship is not turned around, how would that change everyone's day-to-day lives?
It will change everyone's day-to-day life in different ways depending where you live. Mm-hmm. If you live along the seacoast, the principal factor that everyone who lives along the seacoast will experience is rising sea level. Already, we have rising sea levels having big impacts in the Gulf Coast area, along the East Coast, Norfolk, Virginia, and other places around the globe. The delta areas, the low-lying areas, the Nile Delta, the Ganges Delta, All of these are extremely low-lying and even modest rises of sea level inundate large areas and make them terribly vulnerable to storms. So if you live along the seashore, keep your eye on getting your feet wet in the near future. Elsewhere, for instance, here in Michigan, mm-hmm. we have items to experience as well. The Great Lakes will feel the effects of climate change. Interestingly, largely in the opposite direction, the Great Lakes are likely to see lower water levels, and agriculture will experience some new conditions. For instance, the growing season will start earlier, but starting earlier, it also becomes more vulnerable to an occasional quick retreat to a brisk few days of cold weather.
Such as we saw last year when the cherry crop was decimated.
Exactly, and that happened earlier this decade also. Mm-hmm. It will experience more intense precipitation events, so there will be a lot of erosion and runoff and flooding and infrastructure disruption. So agriculture definitely will feel it. And the two principal crops in Michigan, the two big cash crops are corn and soybeans, and both of them show vulnerabilities to higher temperatures. They don't do well at higher temperatures. And so the yield from those is likely to diminish if the temperature continues to rise.
As we hear this, as someone going through their life day to day and you hear the enormity of these stories, it sounds like something that's going to be accomplished with CGI in a science fiction movie, and we're saying give this time and this can happen. I had a conversation about this with someone actually last night, and his point to me was, I accept that climate's changing. I accept that it's getting warmer, but what can I do about it? How can I make a scintilla of difference with the enormity of the changes that seem to be coming? Do you hear that from people as you travel and talk? And what do you say to them?
I do hear that frequently. And my response says that the problem has grown over the last couple centuries from the human activity and the use of the fossil fuels and the loading of the atmosphere with greenhouse gases. Each individual has contributed to that. And so I also feel that each individual can do something that will begin to bring that problem under control. But it is a big problem, and we can't do it individually. We can't do it all alone. We need policies that will redirect the global economy in ways that will be more climate friendly than the current energy sources that we use. And so what can we do individually about that? We do have another piece of strength there. We can all vote. We can make that an important issue with our elected representatives, locally, statewide, federally. If you let your representatives know that climate change is indeed your number one issue, they will begin to recognize that.
You were a consultant on a film called Project Ice that looks at the Great Lakes through ice. And actually, we spoke with the director here on Stateside not long ago. And what do you believe ice tells us about climate change in the Great Lakes region?
Ice plays a big role in the lake levels of the Great Lakes, for instance.
As we've just seen this past winter,
as
right?
As we have. It makes an important point that this last winter was both very cold locally and lots of lake ice near records over the Great Lakes. But the long-term trend, and that's what climatologists look at, is a decline in lake ice. Over the last three decades, there's been a steady decline, decade average, in the amount of lake ice. And that is the long-term trend. And as the temperatures are continuing to rise, that trend, I think, will be resumed, even though we know there can be year-to-year variability. What the ice does, or the lack of ice, mm-hmm. Is that it encourages more evaporation. In the winter months, if there's no ice cover, then the evaporation season becomes year-round. A second thing that it does is that if there is no ice cover, the lakes intercept more sunshine and are warmer, and that preconditions them for a big evaporation season in the late summer and fall. And so it's kind of the 6 months after the lack of lake ice that you see the effects on the lake levels. But the lake levels have been going down. The commercial shipping understands that. Recreational boaters, people with docks along the lake that don't reach the water anymore. These are all issues associated with the changes in lake ice.
There will be a screening of Project ICE at 7 tonight at the Michigan Theater in Ann Arbor, followed by a discussion with a group of experts, including Professor Pollack. And it is my pleasure to be the moderator tonight, and certainly the public is invited. Again, 7 tonight at the Michigan Theater in Ann Arbor. Henry Pollack, University of Michigan Emeritus Professor of Geophysics and 2007 Nobel Peace Prize winner. Thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you.
And now it's time to talk about music. All this week, we're doing a special series about music and asking people a pretty personal question. That question is, what's the song that saved your life? Disa Groves says her song helped her see herself in a new way. She grew up near Los Angeles and moved to Michigan last fall.
I had graduated from college in California, and I felt like I could start this new phase in my life. So I moved across the country from California to Michigan. Different culturally as well as the weather. I moved to a new city. I was very excited. I was looking for a job, and the months went by and I still couldn't find a job. I became very discouraged to the point where I became depressed, and I was losing my motivation to find new jobs, starting to question why I had made the move at all. I was running out of money. I was wondering, would I need to move back to where I had started? One day I was trying to, get up the motivation to get out of bed. I remember that I was in the kitchen. I was making myself something to eat, and I heard the song Roar by Katy Perry. Song came on, and I was just moving, I was dancing, I was happy, and just happy to be where I was, which was something that I hadn't felt in a little while. Just the idea that my voice matters. Some of the lyrics of the song of, you're gonna hear me roar. Putting that importance on the singular or me, it made me realize that it's in my power, it's in my hands, that I can change my own life for the better or for worse. So all of this depression that I was feeling was from my own hands. I couldn't just blame this new place I was in. I couldn't blame the job market. I needed to get up, and I needed to go out, and I needed to do something about it. It reinvigorated me, I guess. It gave me the strength to kind of keep going, and that day I went across the street to the Barnes & Noble. I gave my resume to the manager, and the manager was really impressed that I came in person. I felt like I gave a really good impression. I didn't end up getting the job there, but I felt like it was a turning point in this new area in my life, that it gave me the confidence to keep going and move on.
Stateside's Kyle Norris produced our series, and she wants to hear from you. Do you have a song that saved your life? Tell us the story. Call us and let us know, 248-962-3806. And you can use the hashtag SongSaveMe on Twitter. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Recent headlines and images emerging from the crisis in Iraq have been deeply unsettling as Sunni militants sweep through the country. There have been reports of summary executions and mass killings of Iraqi soldiers and police. The fresh trouble in Iraq puts a spotlight on warfare between Sunni and Shiite sects of Islam. But these are also uneasy times for Christian Iraqis, Chaldeans. Since 2003, some 1 million Iraqi Christians have fled their home country. Since the U.S. invasion of Iraq and the fall of Saddam Hussein caused other groups to see the Chaldeans as U.S. allies, many of those Chaldeans have found new homes in Michigan. Martin Manna is head of the Chaldean Community Foundation. Martin, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Martin, we have seen the reports and we've seen unverified videos posted on the web coming from Iraq showing the ISIS militants, the Sunnis, executing Iraqi soldiers. Yesterday, there was a video showing the militants stopping trucks on the highway, quizzing the drivers to see if they're Sunni or Shiite, not liking the answers they got, not being satisfied, and then reportedly executing them on the spot. With that kind of thing going on, how would Christians fare at the hands of ISIS?
Well, historically, they haven't been faring well in the Middle East overall. So ISIS is such an extreme group, even Al-Qaeda won't even recognize them because of the extremes. I mean, they've been responsible for crucifixions in Syria, beheadings. One of our couple priests were beheaded because of these groups. They've kidnapped some nuns. In Syria, as an example, they took over a Christian town, burned our churches. It is an extreme group that does not tolerate anyone else, that does not follow their extreme views of Islam. And so for the Christian community, who's already been living in so much fear in Iraq, we are receiving daily daily conversations with our community back home. The closest Christian village is less than 5 minutes away from where ISIS is now. It's a village of about 50,000 people. There's an area in Iraq that still has some 350,000 minorities living in that area, mainly Christian, who are very concerned about their security. And many reports have come out that if this community isn't protected now, this will be the last stand for Christians in Iraq who have had a history there that goes back to 45 AD as when they started Christianity there through St. Thomas.
Are you seeing an influx of new refugees coming to Michigan even in these recent weeks as this violence with ISIS has spread?
Well, the challenge is how would they get here? I will tell you we have several requests of more people trying to get out of Baghdad, out of Mosul. Most of the Christians, if not all, have left Mosul. I was actually in Washington, D.C. with the Archbishop of the Chaldean Catholic Church in Erbil in northern Iraq. And we had a chance to have a conversation with the Bishop of Mosul. And there's no Christians remaining in Mosul. And for the first time in 1,600 years, Mass was not celebrated on Sunday in a church in Mosul. And so it just tells you the gravity of what's happening there and the devastation that has been created throughout all of Iraq. And it's not just the Christian community. Mm. If you don't have the same beliefs as this group, I mean, obviously everyone's in danger in that country.
And is it hard to get out?
It's difficult because most of the refugees, and so since 2003, two-thirds of Iraq's Christian community has fled, as has been reported. There were more than 350 churches in Iraq in 2003. Fewer than 50 remain in operation. More than 80 have been bombed. And so they'll seek refuge in other areas like Syria, Jordan, Turkey. But once they go there, they cannot become citizens. They cannot work. They cannot go to school. And so it's a country of refuge, but only temporary until they could get a visa to go to many other places. So we have a large community, for example, now in Sweden, in Australia, in New Zealand, whatever country will allow them to come. In the Metro Detroit area, just to give you an example, there were 4 Chaldean Catholic churches just about 12 years ago. We now have 11 in this area, and the community continues to grow because of the large influx. They'll try to make their way here.
Martin, what are your worst fears for Iraq and for the Christians who make their home in Iraq?
Well, I can't tell you how much we are in fear of eventually ISIS moving into the remaining Christian villages and persecuting our community even more. There's been a genocide that's been going on in the Middle East for quite some time. And people say, well, what does it have to do? Why should I care here in the United States? Well, we spent trillions of dollars there. We've lost so many U.S. lives on that soil. And as the Middle East become more radicalized, as groups like this continue to take more territory, it will impact us all. They feed more terrorism. There's more homegrown terrorism because of it. We cannot allow that ideology to win in that region, because as the Middle East is drained of Christians, while we were only 10% of the population in 2003, we're 40% of the intellect, most of the physicians, the professors, the lawyers. And so there's a huge brain drain going on, and we have to win the hearts and minds of those people there so we could stop this form of terrorism.
Martin Manna heads the Chaldean Community Foundation. Martin, thank you for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
In 2007, the city of Detroit granted Marathon Petroleum a $175 million tax break to expand its refinery. In return, Marathon promised to set up a training program to help Detroiters get jobs at the refinery. A recent Detroit Free Press story raises questions about whether Marathon's promise was a valid one. Reporter Joe Guillen took a close look at four Detroiters who went through Marathon's training program, earned good grades, served internships with Marathon, went on for associate's degrees, and still did not get hired by Marathon. Detroit Free Press reporter Joe Guillen joins us now. Joe, tell us more about just what Marathon promised the city of Detroit 7 years ago.
Well, the main promise they made was to create a workforce development program at a local community college. And they chose Henry Ford, and they had to fund scholarships for this program. So they set up the program, they designed a curriculum, they opened up a competition for the scholarships, and they awarded the scholarships. And during that process, they told the applicants, according to the guys I interviewed, that they would get kind of a leg up on job opportunities at Marathon. And for the company, that's kind of where their commitment ended. They felt that their promise was to create the workforce development program and to make an effort to hire Detroiters. But for a lot of people in city council who approved the tax break, they felt that Marathon was really promising more at the table in discussions when they were debating the tax break. They felt like there was more of a commitment from Marathon to actually get Detroiters jobs. And now, about 7 years later, they see that nobody from the workforce development program has been hired. And on top of that, I mean, not very many Detroiters in general have gotten about what has turned out to be about 200 more jobs at the refinery since the tax break was granted.
So I just want to make sure we get this. So Marathon has added nearly 200 jobs at this expanded refinery over the 7 years.
Right.
You reported they paid $154,000 for 37 training program scholarships for Detroiters. And of those who took the workforce development program, not a single one landed a full-time job.
Right. They, as part of the, another part of the requirement through the tax break is that they have to report employment statistics to the city. And the most recent report was in February, and in that report they stated that they had paid 37 scholarships and awarded 5 internships. And there was no mention of any full-time jobs being given out. The four guys that I interviewed said that nobody had been hired. A top administrator at Henry Ford said nobody had been hired. And when I asked Marathon, they wouldn't respond to any specific questions about the program. There was the administrator at Henry Ford, who's in charge of the workforce training program, said Marathon had offered a job within the last 3 weeks of the story's publication date to an intern, but that hadn't been finalized yet, and that wasn't part of the statistics in that city council report in February. So of those first 37, no, nobody had been hired.
And you spoke with the four men who graduated from the Marathon training program's opening class.
Right.
What kind of grades did they get?
They all got really good grades. One guy got a 3.8, I think two got around a 3.5, and the other got like a 3.4. They showed me their transcripts, and the administrator who I talked to at Henry Ford, who got to know these guys while they were in school, he vouched for their, you know, work ethic, and he said that they were successful in the program.
And did they all serve internships?
Yeah, they all completed about three months internships, and they went basically through the hiring process to get the internships. They went through background checks, drug testing, and they had other tests, physical tests that they had to complete to get the internships, and they were on the job for about 3 months, all four of them, and they completed the internships and got, you know, certificates saying so.
And then clearly they wanted full-time jobs. Were they given any reason for not being hired?
Not all of them. One of the individuals was pretty upset with the fact that he didn't get hired, and he kind of pressed the company, because what would happen is they would simply get an email saying, sorry, we can't offer you further encouragement at this job opening at this time, and without any specific reason. But one of the guys was pretty upset, and he called some people he knew at the company, and eventually they told him verbally that he didn't pass their skills assessment test. And he showed me a copy of what that – they gave him a practice test ahead of time, and he showed me the practice test they gave him. And it was pretty basic, and he just felt that, you know, with the grades he had and the training he had, that he didn't feel like he really failed the test, and they didn't show him, you know, the test results or anything like that. So,
if you've just joined us, I am speaking with Detroit Free Press reporter Joe Guillen, who took a look at questions being raised about promises made by the Marathon Petroleum Company to the city of Detroit when it got a $175 million tax break in 2007, promises that seemed to imply that a training program they were going to set up would help Detroiters get an inside track to jobs at the refinery. So far, that has not happened. And when you reached out to Marathon, you in your story, Joe, you report an email that you were emailed back, and I note this quote from this Marathon spokesman, quote, "We are working to increase the number of candidates who apply for this training program." Well, I don't know about you, but I don't hear any commitment in that to actually hire anyone who's gone through the training program in that statement.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of typical of the message that they've been sending the city ever since they got the tax break. I mean, my interest in this story started back in February when some Marathon representatives came to city council in an open meeting and were pressed about their hiring practices, about the number of Detroiters that they were hiring, which city council felt was a really low number. And that is typical of the answer, that they want to hire Detroiters, that they are committed to hiring Detroiters, but they always stop short of providing a firm commitment. And at this point, it's difficult for city council to hold them to that when, you know, the company's already built its expanded refinery and the tax break has been granted. So some city council members have, you know, said that it speaks to the need to develop these requirements in advance of granting the tax break.
And as you note in your piece, Joe, this Marathon promise of training and jobs was not legally binding. Is that usual? Did the city stumble in not insisting the agreement be legally binding, or is it the norm to just have a handshake deal?
I don't know of any development deals that require a number of Detroiters to be hired in the permanent jobs that result in a development. There are some deals, the Red Wings Arena, for example. During the construction phase of the arena, there are certain requirements that the company hire, I think it's half Detroiters, but those requirements can be worked around with certain project development agreements. But as far as permanent jobs, I don't know of any that have requirements to hire Detroiters, but I think that could be changing in the near future. Brenda Jones is really, you know, an advocate of this, and she said so, and we'll see if she comes up with any kind of legislation to promote that idea.
And, of course, that's the Detroit City Council president. So bottom line, Detroit tax dollars went into supporting the Marathon expansion. The company gets a $175 million tax break and then put $154,000 into scholarships. So that is less than one-tenth of 1% of what they got in the tax break.
That's a pretty good return on investment.
Now, and the city has no recourse at all to recover any of the tax incentives or to force the company to hire as they believe they were going to?
Not that's been identified. There is the Human Rights Department, led by former Corporation Counsel Portia Roberson. She is in the middle of just kind of a compliance check. She's going back to through Marathon to kind of more closely examine their hiring practices, and she's a lawyer by training. And if there is anything the city can do, I think that she will talk about that when her report is due. I think it was 6 months as of February, so it should be later this summer where she completes her review, her deeper review of Marathon's hiring practices.
Joe, given what you reported in your story with this experience over these 7 years with Marathon, is there reason to suspect or believe there are similar deals that seem very one-sided like this, not just with the city of Detroit, but in other cities?
Yeah, I mean, cities are always competing to get these projects. And it seems like they will do almost anything to get the development. With Marathon, they told the city that, you know, what they got was a personal property tax exemption, and they would tell city officials that, hey, we can go to Ohio, Indiana, other neighboring states where they don't levy this personal property tax. Mm-hmm. And so companies seem to always find a way to just kind of find leverage over a city where they're trying to do business. And it's up to city officials to kind of weigh, you know, the costs of providing those benefits. Is it worth it to have this development here in our city? With Marathon, there's environmental concerns. You know, there's all these jobs, and there's the question of did Detroiters, you know, take advantage of these jobs? So that's something that city officials have to kind of weigh when they are considering these tax breaks.
Detroit Free Press reporter Joe Guillen, thanks for speaking with us, Joe.
You're welcome.
Today's program was directed and produced by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer is Peg Watson. Contributors are Emily Fox, Chris Hattelsey, Taylor Mattia, Mercedes Mejia, Omar Saadeh, Kayla Steinberg, and Katie Suha. Support for arts and cultural reporting on Michigan Radio comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. This program's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.